Welcome to The Running Public with Bracken Crocker and Kirk DeWint.
Whether you are a brand new runner or you already have a great mustache,
we're here to help you increase your running knowledge and present it at a practical level. This is The Running Public. When you're ready to take your training or racing to the next level, go to therunningpublic.com. We have both monthly subscription training plans, $19.99 a month, and Bracken and I both offer one-on-one customized coaching. Again, go to therunningpublic.com and check out our offerings. Jared, where are you? You're in Canada, right? Somewhere north?
Yeah, in Gatineau, near Ottawa.
All right. Have you guys had a, down here, so I'm in Minnesota. I'm a drive from the Canadian border, but it's been super mild here. Like, we have no snow on the ground. Our lakes are already opened up. It's been the nicest winter running weather I've had in my 40 years on this planet. Is it like that up there?
Yeah, 100%. We literally only got like sporadic cold days. I think we maybe got one day this whole year, well, the season, minus 30. That's it. Everything else has been very mild. I've rarely had to use my treadmill this whole year. So
yeah, this is wild. Kirk and I received a pair of shoes with studded tips on it to test. I have got to use them three times this winter. The entire winter. Three runs.
Oh, yeah. Like the Yak Tracks?
Yeah, a version of that. Yeah. Okay. It's like every other winter, we would have had the testing done and dusted by now. And this year, three chances to run in icy, snowy conditions. And I'm in Wisconsin, so we share the border with Canada as well. So we're as far north outside of like upstate New York as you can get in this country, and we don't have snow.
Do you think that's a global warming thing? I mean, obviously, like, cyclists and runners love this weather, but it's probably not good if you think about it in hindsight for the summer, right? Because it means this implies that our summer is going to be scorching hot.
Yeah, that's awful. Humid, buggy, hot. I don't want that. And I like winter running, so this is actually terrible for me because we get a dusting of snow and it freezes and then it gets warm and it melts and the trails have been a mess all winter. Like, they can't dry out and they can't freeze over. So I'm selfish. I want it to be not hot in summer and I want it to be not freezing in winter. Like, just give me my perfect running weather year round and I'll be a happy man.
Yeah.
It's not too much to ask.
That's right.
Well, the thing is, at least when you have a cold winter, you have a mild summer associated with it. But it's when the snow just randomly comes, that's what takes people off guard, right? Like, when Florida had snowfall, they were not ready for it. Like, people were panicking. I don't know what year that was, but it was like one year it was extremely cold and they had snow in the first time in 20 years or something. But the heat is never good for runners. It's not. Even though we're good at sweating, we don't like the heat. It affects us a lot. And some others more than others. Others are really good at dispensing heat.
I prefer
the heat. You prefer the heat.
Oh my gosh, give me the heat. Yeah, if we're living in Minnesota, I don't perform well when it's cold. But get me hot and sweaty and overheated, I'll fare better. But I don't know why that is. That's probably like biology, my own personal
metabolism.
Yeah, there's
a little bit of genetics involved.
Yeah. All right, so fill me in, Jared. Last name is Broughton. Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah, that's good. Yep.
Okay. And
Broughton or Broughton, it's up to you.
Broughton, got it. And you brought to us like an interesting conversation that we had to jump on because we've never had anybody approach us with this topic before. And you have sort of an interesting career path. Could you tell us what we're here to talk about a little bit today?
Basically, accessibility. So people with I find that the running community is not aware of the amount of barriers it is to do it for people that cannot see well. Wheelchair is another department. That's another conversation, but exclusively for running, especially for people that can't see well. For example, I'll never be able to drive, so I can't do trail running. So I'm automatically at a disadvantage from what I'm able to get outside my comfort zone. So I'm kind of stuck doing road racing or track, no matter what I do. Otherwise, I'm at the mercy of other people to drive me. Second thing to talk about, why every time you talk to a runner, the first thing that goes like, how fast did you run a marathon? Well, how fast are you? Oh, you got to be faster than your teammates or your group member. There's more to running than racing. And then I guess lastly, from what's on my mind, is how can we make running more of a make it a bit more of a lifestyle than having to go like from race to race, and we have to periodize every single thing we do. And that, why can't we just embrace it for the natural phenomenon that it is, as opposed to always being type-holded to only doing racing and or doing these ultra events. I'm not sure if how does that sound?
Sounds great. I'm interested in you know, especially like the visually disabled, the running aspect, yeah, as a whole, more in particular, like understanding how you got to this point. Why don't you start by letting us know more who you are, like where you grew up. Like, you know, you said you're visually impaired, and so this has been a big part of your, yeah, upbringing and your relationship with running. Like, could you talk us through, like, you started childhood? Where did this all start, man?
Okay, I tried to integrate in a regular school up until grade two, and then I didn't get the support I needed. So my mom sent me away to a private boarding school for people that who are blind and visually impaired and even deaf. And while I was there, I found the school was more focused on sports because they thought of us as less people. They babied us. And the one thing they were very good at was sports programs. They had so many activities, had so many resources that my brothers didn't have access because they were regular sighted. And I had this one person who never gave up on me. He was like cross country track coach / gym teacher. And he gave me a lot of attention that he didn't give to other people. And he just loved my enthusiasm for things. But even though I was kind of chubby, it was hard for me to kind of find what I was truly good at other than sport. I was just thrown into things because everyone's told, oh, Jared, you have to exercise. You're getting fat, right? I was always picked on for that. And this one coach believed in me so much that it had a profound impact on me. He basically said to me, like, I tried cross country 1 year, could barely finish 3K without collapsing. And he just looked at me one day and he says, you know, Jared, you have potential, don't waste it. And just that very single statement and the fact he gave me his time and he never gave up on me made me committed to running. Because it's like, okay, obviously I don't resonate with swimming. I can't do cycling competitively. I can't play soccer. I can't play hockey. I can't play baseball. That was the one sport that I was better at from the average person. And he saw that in me. And so like, damn, I want to be like him one day. And then obviously when I came back to regular school here, I wanted to fit in. And I realized that, wow, you know, I'm actually pretty good at this once I dedicated my time to it. And when you realize if something's important enough to you, you'll get better at it and it becomes a natural habit. And not only did I lose weight, my whole mentality changed. Running made me a committed person. I wasn't committed to school until running came into my life. Running forces you to stay committed and be consistent. You have no choice or you'll lose all those fitness benefits and those health benefits at the same time. Because I couldn't play other sports in school, I just kind of stayed on the track team in a controlled environment. And by that time, I was around 18, 20 years old. And then I joined a serious running track club. And then I did that for 3 years. But now I'm getting outside of childhood. But essentially, I've been doing this for nearly 17 years, ever since I started. When I was a kid, I technically didn't start running until I was around 17, because he started to notice my potential in the sport as someone with a visual impairment. So like, don't waste this. You can't do other things, but you're good at this. Don't let it go. And it was that, wow, revolutionary. I wish there were more coaches like that. And there's not enough of them in this world.
That's So powerful, and I do want to dig into that, but I'm already sidetracked, which you'll learn we get sidetracked a lot on this podcast.
Fair enough.
Prior to going all in on running in my life, I was a special education teacher, but it was based around cognitive disabilities. So any, like my day-to-day life was dealing with disabilities, but it was always from a cognitive standpoint. So anyone who was blind or visually impaired, it was paired with cognitive disabilities as well. And so I'm fascinated from the other side of the coin, blind, visually impaired with no cognitive disability. What did a school like that? You said a private boarding school for people with simply sight disabilities. Yeah, what was a school like that? Like from the, how was it set up? What did coursework look like? How were sports enacted?
Wow. That is such a profound question. I love it. So you're at opening a can of worms here, just so you know. So first thing it's, you have to, different residences, because you don't want like little kindergartens hanging out with high school people, right? So there was different residences, and you would go, as you got older, you would go to these different residences. Like, for example, junior, intermediate, senior would obviously mean like 15 and up. Anyways, so it would start from kindergarten and you'd finish in grade 12. So technically you could say your entire school career in that one school. That was quite an advantage. Because it was boarding school, people would travel from across Ontario because it was an Ontario school in Canada. So there was a lot of commuting, and it had a weird experience on my ability to maintain friends, because every friend I ever had lived long distance when I was at home. So I was there, I would only go home every other weekend, and I would take a plane home because I lived, you know, it was about several hours away. The school system wasn't the greatest because they kind of coddled you a little bit too much. Yeah, the advantage was you got this an individual attention. So think of a regular public school system. So high school, for example, you'd have 30 kids, or, you know, 30 kids in a class. There'd be only six of us, maximum eight in one class. Mm-hmm. But the problem is, just because you can't see what doesn't mean you're not a visual learner. It's like some people just naturally need to see something or have it physically done, like shown how to do it, as opposed to auditory. They taught auditorily. They didn't teach you how to do it. They just taught you, like, they tell you how to do it and you're supposed to do it. It's like math. They didn't use the chalkboard. They would just use the textbook. You're supposed to just pay attention. So there's no size fits all. And that one, they kind of fit you into this little, in this box, and you had to either fit in or you didn't. So despite the individual attention, you were kind of like, oh no, we'll give them a second try, or I don't know how to say this. Like they were too forgiving. Like, mm-hmm. He's visually impaired. He's not as, like, it's kind of like a form of belittling, essentially. And as a result, I matured slower as an adult. And because I can't read body language very well, I can't see someone's rolling their eyes. I can't see someone closing their eyes sometimes. And lighting is a big issue. So the thing is, because the counselors would not communicate exactly what they're mean, because they're not our parents. And so you have this emotional dissonance where it's like, you don't really connect with them because they're not their parents. They don't love you. They don't owe you anything. They're paid to be there. And so when you're in this residence, you're living with these people all day long, and you go to school with them. So it's a very interesting experience, but you do get, you know, a very different relationship with your family as a result of that. The sport program. So let's get into the sport program. This is where it gets interesting. Sport
program. I do have one follow-up on that though.
Pardon?
Before you get into that, I do have one follow-up because I'm very curious. So the concept of having to learn math or something like that without visuals is terrifying to me.
It is.
Does it progress to a point where it's Braille-based math, so you can at least see manually?
Yeah, you can. But the thing is, you're only reading it. But if you don't understand it, you're only relying on the teacher to explain it to you, because there's no other way to demonstrate it.
Right.
I don't know how else to explain that.
No, it makes sense. It's just I've not thought of it from that perspective, that every concept you have to actually learn to the point where you can use it has to be done.
So math was one of the hardest ones to do. If it was English, you don't need to see to learn a language. So The languages were okay. It was dependent on the teacher. Some teachers are better than others. We all have our favorite teacher. Like, you know, it's pretty normal stuff in that sense. But the thing is, a lot of these teachers didn't relate to us. You know, it's like some of them were very, they had a good sense of humor, but they thought of us as less. Like, oh, you're going to have a lot of trouble later in life. So they let us off the hook too much. Yeah, it was not a normal upbringing, but it brought me to running. I learned a new sport. I learned how to play goalball. I was on the swim team for 7 years, which is not something you get in regular school system. They have an amazing track team.
You want to explain goalball for people who aren't familiar? Because this is it's a cool sport, but most people have no contact with this in their everyday life.
So this is like the opposite of cardio. Well, there's a little bit of cardio involved when you're actually training for it. Think of a court. So it's like a volleyball court. You have two sides. You have three positions on either side. So you can have a team of six, three people on the court at the same time. So you have 3 points, boom, 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 like that. So you have a center, left and right. You're shooting the ball that has bells in it to make noise because you're blindfolded. So it's a blind sport. So you're blindfolded. It's specially designed for blind people and a lot of visual people. Like it takes them a long time to get used to this. You're rolling the ball like you're bowling. So think of it like bowling. In a bowling motion, you're rolling the ball as fast as you can to the other court and passing their line within the volleyball a boundary. And then if you pass, then you score. And then they defend the ball. They shoot it back. It's a very simple sport with some obvious rules involved.
And it's a cool sport because it levels the playing field. And that you don't have to have a visual impairment to play it because they blindfold you.
You just need blindfolded. Absolutely. And it's one of the – it's like the in the Paralympics, the goalball is like the shiz. You know, like everyone in the Paralympic, like people wait for the goalball championships. It's like their prime event. Mm-hmm. Goalball is what people go to see, like a stadium full of people, and it has to be quiet. Like it's the ones where you have to be super quiet as an audience member, and the only time you can make noise as an audience is when someone scores. It's interesting. It's like no other sport where you have to be super quiet all the time for attention because the people need to hear where the ball is coming from to defend it. And I got really good at that sport growing up. Yeah. I was almost on the national team, but then I went back to regular school. So
that's fascinating. You know what that reminds me of, Bracken? That reminds me of, talk about dead silence while participating in a sport. NCAA Nationals, the trials rounds. You'd be in like a gymnasium, like an indoor track full of people, and you'd be running the 1500 meter like semis, and it'd be crickets because it wasn't the final, so nobody was invested. So you'd be at like the national championship, and it'd be like you might as well have been in your own backyard running. At least that was my experience. I could have heard a goal ball then for sure. I don't know why it brought me right back to that silent indoor track running, but okay, so we have like. You open so many cans of worms, you don't even know it, Jared. We're question askers. You're gonna get to know that. Like Bracken, I'm sure you have a whole chamber full of questions about all of this already, and so do I. And ultimately, we want to get to like the specifics of like being visually impaired and running, and all the nuances that you must deal with on the day to day basis. But for the listeners, just to understand, let's just consider like perfect vision 2020, whatever that even means, right? Okay. What do you see compared to like someone with full vision? Just so the audience understands.
Okay, so first, to be obviously, everyone's eye condition is different. That can't see well. So for me specifically, light sensitivity. So I can't go outside without my sunglasses anymore unless I want to have eye damage long term. I have no depth perception. So when I say I can't do trail running, I really can do it without spraining my ankle or falling 1,000 times. Mm-hmm. Probably not something I should be doing unless I'm a thrill seeker, which I'm not. The best I do with thrill seeking is navigating through traffic. That's the extent of my thrill seeking.
That's very dangerous, I imagine.
So trail running, ultra marathon, I'd love to do it. I want to make everyone very clear that I would love to try that. but I just can't. I'd have to be guided. I'd have to be mercy if you have someone giving me a ride to do it. So yeah, just to give you an idea, everything seems flat and the lighting has a significant impact on that.
Okay. Quick question. Everything's going to happen. We can understand, see, having depth perception, we can understand what a lack of depth perception looks like because we can see 2D.
Yeah.
How does one explain what depth perception is to someone who has none? How did you come to grasp what the difference is between what you see and what we perceive?
Like shades. So I'll use snow as an example. So you have the pavement, and as I'm moving across the ground, changes color, I'm a little more alert. Like my brain is naturally more alert. So I automatically have to slow down. So my instincts are slow down. Your guys' instinct is just, okay, well, I see something coming up 100 or 50 feet in front of me. I know when to jump. I can only see it within 10 feet or 20 feet, depending on what it is. So my experience is that people are going to say I'm really boring here, but I almost do the same route all the time, especially the more technical the workout is. So the faster I have to run, the more that I'm more likely to repeat the same route because I memorize. So my memory is more high tuned. So I have more of an identical memory because I'm forcing myself to be like, okay, I don't want to be a slave to the treadmill. So I'm going to repeat the same route without having to go to a track and memorize where those potholes are so that I don't have to think about where the depth perception is, because depth perception is like, where is a step? Okay, so it's like if you think of a 3D dimensional object, as opposed to like flat, like you're playing Mario, super like, you know, Mario, it's more of like if you face it, there's like a next level or there's a depression. Or there's a pothole, there's obviously a little divot there. So the divots and the potholes are the hardest, or the snow rocks, because they can be perceived differently because it may be a sheet of ice, but actually there's a rock or like a sheet of snow. I'm not sure. Sometimes a little, there's so much trial and error that so a lot could of people just take it for granted.
It could be a rock or a depression. You're not sure if it sticks up two inches or depresses 2 inches.
Yeah, I can't. Like there's no way of measuring that. It's not possible. And in the dark, it's even worse. Obviously that's kind of goes without saying anyone be in the same boat. And then I can't see far. So I can only see about, I don't know, 100 meters in front of me, but I can't identify it. So as soon as someone walks about, I don't know, 20 feet away from me, I can't tell if it's a male or female. I can only tell the colors that are on their back or their hair color. Fortunately, like I said, at least I can see color perfectly, but I wouldn't be able to identify if someone was a man or a woman or who they are. That's where the voice comes to the auditory. It's like, oh, that's Kraken. I can hear his voice.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, for sure.
Immediately, like, I wonder.
That's the easiest
immediately
way
I wonder about. That makes sense. No, and it makes me wonder immediately. And I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves because I still want to go back to when you decided to actually go to whatever regular school in quotes and then find your running. I want to talk through that. Yeah. But now it makes me curious right away, like jumping into a local road 5K or even a track race with other competitors, is that astronomically intimidating or even possible for most visually impaired? Like, how do you approach something like that with other bodies and legs and people? What does that look like?
It's an interesting question. Most of the time, once you've been in like a group setting, you kind of get used to it. I mean, everyone has different levels. Like if you see fog, then you're going to need a guide, right? If you're so worried of running into someone, like, oh, you can see a chase, but you don't know if it's a fire hydrant or a person or like a block, a curb, then you need a guide, right? There's things called tethered. Like there's a strap and the person will be running beside you. But the problem with the tether, the pet peeve I have with the tether is that you can't move your arm full the way back. So you're compromising your stride and your arm swing. So you can't go as far. And therefore one leg is having to work harder than the other, and your arm too. And your upper back is affected as well because you're like almost twisting more to get the same reaction biomechanically. So like when you're tethered, because there's no other way to do it, for me, at least I like when someone's in front of me, because if they are jumping over a pothole, I'm jumping over a pothole. Like, they wouldn't be purposely trying to go toward a big divot. They would be moving around it. That's so it's like, mm-hmm. I kind of have trust when people do it, because they're not going to purposely injure themselves or fall. If they see an ice, they're going to run around it or jump over it. And then I follow them. It's like mimics. So I mimic what people do and I just memorize that. I just try to avoid routes where it's really, where the road is not well done. Just mm-hmm. put it that way. Especially in Canada, like the roads here are terrible. That's why I love bike paths. Right. But like mass starts are the worst for me. I hate mass starts of any race. It doesn't matter the distance. With the exception of track races. COVID was great for you.
Was COVID great for your racing?
No, it wasn't.
I assume that you wouldn't have any mass starts anymore. Then you could just start every minute.
Yeah. Well, virtual racing is, it has its place, but in my opinion, you could basically define it as a time trial, because it's not an mm-hmm. official race. Like I had to do my marathon because I signed up and I already did the training for it. And then COVID happened. So I did a virtual marathon. I'm like, okay, well, it was good mental training. I didn't come very close to my PV. So it was something. Mm-hmm. It was something. I wouldn't do it again. I wouldn't do it again.
Gotcha.
It would be tough.
But
to,
I think it's just the camaraderie aspect of it.
It would be tough, I imagine, to be visually impaired and then to be fast and visually impaired. I have to imagine, and we'll get to all that, I think, but like you have less and less people that can run with you if you're an accomplished visually impaired athlete. That has to be a whole tricky thing in itself. Yeah. Like how many people are as fast as you and yet can complete a marathon and yet like, oh my goodness, like is that a roadblock of yours?
Yeah, it is. It is. Like there are workouts that I'd love to be paced or do a group with, but because I have to take the bus everywhere, I don't have the time it takes me too long to get certain places. So I can't join certain running groups that I'd like. And then I kind of have some times where I have to rely on the treadmill, because the treadmill does the pace for me, right? So I can just completely zone out. That's the problem, is like sometimes I just get so tired. Like I literally just have days where it's not even that I don't look forward to running. It's that I don't look forward to the cars and the traffic. I don't have the mental concentration to do it. So just think of it like this. You know how you may bother, it may be tiring for you to worry about footing and stuff. Like for me, it's double, if not 10 times more. It requires 10 times the amount of concentration for me to worry about cars and terrain and all that stuff. So when we can zone out from our runs, that to me is very liberating. I think that's why people love it, because it's like an escape, right? It's good for our mental health. But if I'm so focused on my footing, I might as well just be trail running, because I'm not zoning out. I'm sort of enjoying the process, but I'm like, oh, I'm slipping, or I have to dodge things, or I have to be alert. It's just hard to disconnect. I'm not sure if that resonates with any, like with you, but it's just, I'm not even sure that answers the question. It's just very tricky, because unless I'm running with a group, I spend more mental energy to do it unless I'm on the treadmill or on the track or something like that. Because like, again, like I was saying earlier, the track is a very controlled environment. The only problem is you're going in circles a lot. That's the only disadvantage. But then anyone could say the same thing for the treadmill. So I teach their own. I just like the treadmills. Like I can completely zone out and I don't have to think about anything. I'm just like follow the workout. It does it the pace for me. No issues, no injuries. It's like, I know a lot of people are going to disagree with me, but that's reality of the treadmill, right? It's teach their own. And what I've been able to do to accommodate myself in the winter when I don't have the concentration or I worry of getting hurt. Like to me, it's not worth risking one run. Just like, it's not worth getting injured over one run. That's like, oh man, I just, you know, anyways, it's a risk assessment all the time. Unless I'm in the summer or something like that. Like sometimes I pick my battles. Like if the sun's at eye level, I try not to run outside because then I can't see. Like I literally can't see because the sun's blinding me if I'm heading toward the sun. So that makes it even more complicated. That's why I love running in groups, not just for the camaraderie, but I think it's like I'm following their lead. So it's like the equivalent of me running on the treadmill. The treadmill's pacing me and I'm chasing someone. It's the same concept, but we're social beings. So we like to be in groups. Like we were raised as hunter-gatherers, right? We love to run in a pack. There's something to be said there.
Yeah. Yeah, I can't fathom not being able to check out mentally on runs.
Yeah, exactly.
Like I'm very much, I'm either running a workout or I'm running an easy recovery run where I just may not think about running for the entire run. And that would completely change the run for me if I had to think about it the whole time. That's not something that's ever crossed my mind.
Yeah, exactly. So that's why this is when I say it. This is the one sport where I can sort of be independent about it. Everything else, I'd have to be on a tandem bike or something like else, or I wouldn't be able to compete with my regular. I'm like, this is the one sport where, you know, I actually see some talent where I'm better at it than some of my sighted counterparts. That to me is pure equality right there. I'm like, why would you waste that ability? Like, I just, like, life is way too short. It's like, I think that's one of the beautiful things about having a disability is that it forces you to find your strengths and not take anything for granted. So it has its silver lining as well.
So you started running, you went from the visually impaired school back to like regular school, whatever we want to call that. And you made the switch back. You were still in high school, I think you would call that. I don't, do they call it high school in Canada?
Yeah.
High school? Okay.
Yeah, we call it high school. Yeah.
Okay. That's funny. In this moment, I realized I didn't know if that was true. So you went back to high school and you found running. It was there where you started to run. Is that correct? Like, walk us through that process, like starting up as a visually impaired runner, like what that was like.
Well, again, I started when I started my last year at my boarding school is when my coach, my mentor told me that it'd be good at running. Don't waste the talent, right? Et cetera, et cetera. Right. And when I left to have a kind of a regular upbringing, because I missed my family, I missed my parents, I wanted to have regular friends. I joined the cross country team because, you know, there was nothing else because I couldn't do any other sports. I wasn't going to qualify for the other sport. I wasn't eligible. So I'm like, running was the one thing. I'm like, okay, great. I'm screened in. But then the first thing I was just noticing is I got more injured during cross country than almost my entire running history. Like, I just can't do cross country. I know tons of runners in my network that love cross country. I just can't do it. I can do it, but I just can't run fast. I just can't.
How'd you get injured?
Oh, just like potholes, mud or fall. I didn't see how steep a hill was. Roots. Oh, there's so many things because it's like level one of trail running, essentially. I find that cross country is glorified trail running because it's like faster than trail running pace, but cross country is like full out on grass and varying terrains and inclines and declines. So I realized like, I really love this, but I realized what I was really good at was sustaining a pace and zoning out for long periods of time. But I wasn't able to do that on the cross country team. But I was like, at least I was part of a team. So that was the part that motivated me to continue it. But then when I got into track, when we got into track season in high school, that's when I kind of saw like, geez, you know, if I really focus on this, I can get pretty good at it or pretty fast within my disability. And there was a chance I had to go to like the Canadian Champions or something like that for high school, or I don't know what the name was of it, but it's like, well, Jared, you're the only one in the category. You get to go. But like, I actually refused. I chose not to go to the competition because if I didn't want to go at a PD, I wanted to qualify just like everybody else. And the only reason I got to go was because I was the only visually impaired person in the whole school. I didn't feel like I earned it. I didn't it's not like qualifying for Boston. It didn't feel right. Like I wanted to fit in with everybody else. Like I didn't want to be babied. I didn't, you know. Yeah.
How many times, like, we're just breaking it down because this is very interesting to me. Like in a cross country race, sounds like you ran 3K or 5K in high school, somewhere in there.
Oh, I don't know. Yeah.
Like, Did it come to a point where like it was like not worth towing the line? Like you would fall every race and it would be more of a fear-based thing? Or could you or were you able to complete the season and then track was such a relief because it was at least a predictable surface?
Yes. Yeah. All of that. All of the above. I mean, you kind of took it out of my mouth. Yeah. Oh. It was all of it. I just didn't enjoy. I was always so nervous. So nervous because I'm like, oh my God, I'm going to have to go slower. Like I finished the race. So my only way that I could do it near, like when I was in grade 12, the only way I could get through cross country is if I slowed down my run. Of course, I wouldn't get a good of a place, but I didn't even care about my time or anything. I just wanted credibility. Be like, good job, Jared. I just wanted that encouragement from other people. That's all I wanted. Because like, I just love girls and everything like that. You know, like teenage stuff, guys, you know, like I just... Like people are like, you know, Jerry, girls find that attractive, you know, really fast guys. And just like those little things motivated me so much to stay on the team because like I never found that to be true
in high school.
Yeah.
Because you weren't fast or because I you weren't good looking fast. Or what, Bracken?
I don't know. I was fast. It didn't work. No interest.
Maybe
I should have been
being humble.
Yeah, it's good.
So, all right. So let's talk track then. So you get to track, you realize like you love it. I agree. It's more of a level playing field, right? Mano y mano. You can compete with the fully, you know, people who see normal in quotes. So like walk us through your running journey after that then. I'm very curious how you progressed. Obviously you've become competitive. You mentioned the Boston Marathon, like qualifying standard, things like that. So walk me through the progression. Like when did you really get the bug and start like working towards times?
Such a good question. I think when I, so what I loved about, cause so in grade 11, we had this, we had to do a 10K, like our fitness for our grade. We had to do the Ottawa race. We had to do a local 10K cause you guys probably won't know this. The Ottawa race weekend, you know, in Canada, have you ever heard of it?
No,
never heard of it. Okay. So it's a major race in Canada here. It's a national race. Thousands of people do it, over 40,000 people are on it. I'm on the board of directors for it, FYI, wink. So we had to do a 10K for our fitness class, for gym class in grade 11. And I think it's when I did that, I'm like, wow, you know, I did better in that race than in cross country. And I just love the consistency of it. So my very first road race was a 10K. My very first race was a 10K, 2007. I'm like, you know, this was pretty fun. It was damn hot, but it was, I enjoyed that more than having to navigate trees, roots, rocks, mud, little random hills on the grass that I can't see, holes in the ground, etc. So I enjoyed that race in scorching heat versus that, the cross country one. So, and then once I got into track, I'm like, well, you know, I can actually dial out. I can actually dial in here. I can actually dial in my pace. And then once I realized that, man, this is exhausting to do this like mentally, then I joined a gym in high school. I was constantly on the treadmill a lot. I'm like, I'm just so focused on trying to get to a solid pace because there were so many guys that I looked up to that I wanted to be as fast as. And so I would just be consistent. I'd be on the treadmill four times a week. And then I'd go to practice, you know, the school practices. And then when I was 20, when I graduated high school, I did my first half. And then after that, people are like, you know, Jared, you could do a good marathon with that in half marathon time. And then I did my first marathon at 20 years old. And then people in the track, in my local track club, started noticing that. And so like, you know, Jared, you could sign up. You know, you could be part of my classification is T13. Anyways, I don't want to go into the specifics, but it's like, it just means that I have a certain amount of capacity versus someone that's completely blind.
Okay.
Well, it means I'm not given a guide, but it means I'm in a special qualification window. So like my times are easier to obtain than a sighted person. So after I did my first marathon, then people started to notice. Then I was on a professional track team. Then I got to the national level doing middle distance. The problem is with that is I realized I was very good at long distance. But my coach at the time wasn't very supportive of that. It's like, Jared, you're wasting all your time doing all this long distance. If you got to do this shorter distances now and use all your fast twitch. But it was that support because it just, I didn't get the kind of support I wanted because it was all kind of like throw you in, I don't know how, it's like a model where you throw the eggs at the wall and whatever one doesn't break survives. So I didn't survive in that kind of environment for too long because it was all like kind of size fits all. They kind of put you into one box and you follow these workouts. And then, cause in the fall they would do cross country. I'm like, oh, I don't want to do these workouts. I don't care. I'm not interested. I'm not good at it. It's not something I can just improve on. That's what people forget. It's like, oh, Jerry, you just got to practice it. Okay. Yeah, sure. I'll just put my mind to it and my vision will get better overnight. It's like, this is why I like trying to talk to people about it. They don't understand. They don't understand. I don't care if you're a runner, but if you don't understand, there's no point in me talking about it. So I'm very irritable. I'm very passionate about this subject. So it's like, I just wanted to do track because I didn't need accommodations. I didn't need tweaks. I just want to support about like the things that I'm very good at. And I was trying to find something where I didn't have to accommodate my vision for. I could just fit in just like everybody else. And then over time I secretly did a bunch of marathons and halves. And then I was like, you know, this is pretty good. And then, I did that for a few years. I took a break from racing because I was raced out. I was burnt out. I've been injured, burnt out. I've seen it all. I've experienced a lot. I think that summarizes it nicely. It's just not something that anyone on my track team could understand, especially in high school. But I just wanted people to be like, wow, if he can do it, I can do it kind of mentality. Because like I just didn't make any excuses for myself because it's like I have this ability. I don't want to waste it because I don't want others to think less of me that on my track team and all this stuff. Because it's like the ability for me to reach my potential is so important to me because it's like you don't want to live feeling like what if, right? You don't want to live in regret. Because we live in this beautiful sport where all you need is a pair of shoes, literally. I mean, you can run out naked, but it's not socially ideal. But that's literally it. And it's like you don't need a lot of vision to do it, and that's why I love the simplicity of it. You just got to learn how to zone out and feel more relaxed, you know. It's like, I don't want others to think, like belittle me just because I can't see well. But at the end of the day, yeah, there are things I will never be able to do, which is a shame. Otherwise I would need to be guided and stuff. But once I found the environment that I excelled in, I just stuck to it as long as I possibly could. And that's kind of where I'm at today. And I want to spread this wisdom to the world. Because it's like just learning to be very focused. Because my experience is a prime example of what being very focused can mean. You can be very good at something if you narrowly focus on it and just like that's like be a student of the sport. If you be a student of the sport, you can accomplish a lot, regardless of your disability. It's just like it's just a matter of confidence and all that. You know.
Mm-hmm. I was just waiting for Bracken to jump in. Bracken, you looked like you had something in the chamber.
Okay. Jared, so you're aware there's about a 2-second delay from Kirk to myself. Oh, so okay, sometimes I pause. I'll pause to give him the chance for me to not talk over him again. Mm. And then that might seem like you're not getting a response, but it's just a built-in delay. Okay. That's all that is. So you were running track because that was your safest place to race at the time.
Exactly.
You wanted to run long distance, but the coach was funneling you into short distance.
Yeah.
And early on you said, we have this thing. The first thing people ask is, what are your times?
Yeah.
But I am going to ask you that because you said you were successful.
Yeah.
So when you first started running and you had success at the marathon and people started to notice, and then your coach said, we need to run fast twitch and slow, you know, middle distance. Mm. What were you running in both realms right there? What was your marathon best? What was your track best for each distance? So we can get a handle on how that running progression was happening for you.
So my very first one is like, I didn't know any speed training for the marathon. Like this is before I was on the track team, right? Just work there on the professional, track club. My first one was 3:19 and I was like, whoa. And because I've never done it before. I didn't know what to expect. And I was, people were like, wow, just imagine if you train for that. And so once I started doing a little bit of speed training with the track club, I got significantly faster. I got it down to a 310 while I was at the track club. This is during the time my coach wasn't very supportive. And then middle distance, I got down the fast I ever ran in the 1500. I'm not sure if this is a limited, like, this is not my vision at this point. No matter how hard I tried, I couldn't get any faster than a 4:30. So 4 minutes and 30 seconds for the 15 and then a 2:15 in the 800. The 5K, I did pretty good in the 5K. I did a 16:50. I did in a local 5K road race. And I was with the track club at the time. So the fastest I ever ran at the shorter distance was with a track club, but I was limited my potential training for the marathon because my training wasn't specific for enough, was not specific enough, but it gave me a really good jumping point, a fantastic jumping point. But then at that point I was tired of the whole model and it wasn't customized for me. So I left and I found another coach and then I moved on. So
what age was this when you decided to leave the track club? How long had you been with the track club, from what ages to what age?
Three years. So I went from 2012 to 2015. And then I went to another coach. And then I focused on the 10K. And then I PB'd in the 10K of 37:21. And then I was just kind of tired of marathons for a while and all that stuff. I just did a bunch of 5Ks on the road. I took a break from racing. So I took a break from 20. To answer your question, so that was 2010. So I was on the track club for 2012. So I was about 22. And then I left around 25. So I left a track around 25, 26, around that range. And then, then I went solo with another coach for a few years. Then I got burnt out. I was tired of racing, tired of the pre-race jitters and stuff like that. I couldn't do it. I couldn't handle it. I just raced too much. That's basically what it is. The track club was with, I raced too much and I was exhausted. So when I tried to go for another coach, I was already burnt out. And then I got a few injuries, listened to my body, trying to figure things out, experiment, right? After that, and I took 2 years off racing and then the marathon bug came out. And then by that time it was already 2020. So this is about 4 years later. And then 2020 happened and I did my virtual marathon and then I was addicted to the marathon again. And here we are. And then my PB in the marathon is 302, to be specific.
Okay. Wow. Very good. So what did you do for those two gap years? When you were burnt out and tired, what did you do?
I focused on my career. I was more focused on my career. I was more focused on joining running groups. So I just wanted to be part more of the running community. Again, I was really focused on my career because I put so much of that on hold because I realized I wasn't going to the Paralympics because I wasn't – the Paralympics Canada wasn't very like compassionate or anything like that. They didn't give me a lot of financial support. I was carded for a year, but it didn't help me get to the level that I wanted to because the coaching I had was too generic. It wasn't customized for me. So I feel like I was being let down. Like I was just a tool, right? Like I was just a body in the club. So I didn't like to be treated that way anymore. And then I realized that I didn't have the talent to, like, as for give you context, the 5K. So the event that I wanted to do in the Paralympics was the 5K, was the best event I could do on the track, was the most one I was had the most ability. Their qualifying time for T13 was sub 14:45. I was a 16:50. There was no physiological way I can make that much progress in 2 years. No way. At that speed, very few people can make that kind of progress. The marathon is another story. That's another conversation. But I knew that no matter how hard I tried with the coaching system that I was under, I had to let it go. And that's where I got burnt out because I put so much pressure on trying to get to the international level that I smelled the roses and I became a realist at that point. I realized that you can't always get what you want. There was that level of disappointment and grief that came along with it. That's why I changed coaches because I had nothing to lose. I wanted to go in a different direction, but then a year and a half later, I got burnt out from all that training and the mental burnout then I was tired of getting injured. And then I spent those 2 years just kind of refocusing on my career, trying to make money and trying to give back to the sport. That's what I tried to do for those 2 years. And then I fell in love with the marathon again because I realized, geez, what I was doing was not sustainable. So I was learning from the past, right? And I've never been injured since. And it was like those two revolutionary years. I've never been injured since. So I haven't been injured full out in over 5 years or 6 years.
I want to ask about that. But first, this might be an ignorant question, but when you talk Paralympic qualifying standards, is that across the board regardless of classification?
No, that's just for running, like 5K for T13 for like visual impairment. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to pick on the 5K. So I don't remember the other distance. I just know the 5K one. Actually, that's not true. The marathon, so the Paralympic marathon was 2:40 for my classification.
And how much does it vary?
I didn't even break 3 hours yet.
How does that vary classification to classification?
That's a good question. So T13, then T12 would be like 3 hours. There's almost like a 20-minute gap. So 2:40 for T13. So T12 would be someone that doesn't see well, like tunnel vision. Someone that only sees shapes, that's a T12. And then T11 is plain and simple blind, right? So they would be like at a 3:20.
Okay.
Yeah, so like anyone that's completely blind, if they did like a 3:15 or a 3:20 or something like that, you could get into the Paralympics or something like that. But then you'd have to get on the team. Like it's so complicated. It's beyond politics. It's too complicated to get into this venue, but it's you have to make the qualifying time, but then it's up to the Paralympic body, governing body, to decide who goes to the Paralympics.
So like, the time is not enough. It just gets you in the door.
It opens the door for you, but even then there's no guarantee. And that's the part I hated, is that you could work your ass off and you could destroy people's dreams. I'm like, no, that's not my cup of tea. So it was hard for me to stomach that.
So two questions. One popped into my head as you're chatting. You mentioned like you ran 16:50 in a road race. Maybe you're around 20 or whatever it was when you were with that track club.
I was around 2015. I was 25 when I did that. Yeah. That's when I peaked. Yeah.
So do you feel like being visually impaired actually in a situation like that keeps you from truly running to your potential? Like, do you believe like with the same fitness, if you could see fully, you could have maybe run 16:20 that day, but there were 30 seconds of cautionary movements and this and that. Like, do you think you'll ever be able to see your potential in an environment like that? Or do you think that you can't empty the tank like you want because you're held back a little bit sometimes in those environments?
Oh, I love it. I love these questions, guys. I like it. So this is a disclaimer. Yeah, I think that's true. I think the track, the road is always going to be a limiting factor for me unless someone's guiding me. So like, for example, I'm going to Boston. So my very first Boston, yay. And sweet. I'm going to have two guides because I want to set myself up for success. So am I at a point where my vision's slowly going away? Like I'm starting to lose a little bit of vision in my depth perception. So I want to be set up for success. So I advocate for myself. I'm like, okay, you know what? I want guides. And it's all about reaching out to the right people, right? Like you guys. But on the road, that's when I need guides. I don't need guides on the track. I'm just like anybody else. But someone could cut me off. I won't see them because I don't have my peripheral vision's not the best. But either way, it's just one of those things where I do feel limited if the roads are not the best. Because what happens is I'm looking at the ground most of the time on the road. On the track, I'm looking completely straight, no problem, right? I'm just following the line. I'm just making sure I'm not going into lane two or I'm seeing someone in front of me. I just passed them. It's at least I have the vision for that. So I don't feel as limited on the track, barely at all, as much, thankfully, knock on wood. But it's the roads where as soon as I try a different road race somewhere else, I'm not as confident. You could not make me more confident. There's not enough mental training that you could give me to make me feel more confident going into a road race that I've never done before. I'd have to do the race multiple times. I can't give you an exact number. Teach their own. It depends how alert I am. It depends how fit I am. It depends how bright it is. Depends on the time of day. So there's all these variables that influence that outcome. Yeah, I think that's the best way I can explain in a nutshell.
But
that resonates. Go ahead.
I was going to say, well, You know, there's a version of that. I mean, that makes sense. But either way, it's like, so, you know, when you're splitting hairs as an athlete and a runner, Bracken, you know this, we've done it our whole life. Like, you have to get it perfectly on your PR days, like on your PB days. It's like, not only did I feel good, but I was mentally aligned, my body was ready to work, and I executed flawlessly and squeezed every ounce of juice I could out of myself that day. And even one partial step or one hesitation on the road, well, now multiply that by 100 because you're visually impaired, and suddenly you've lost seconds, if not more, out there, not because of run ability, but because of confidence in your step. And so it's just like acknowledging that has to be an interesting take. I see why you'd gravitate towards the track. It's just on the track as an adult, as a fully, you know, visual adult, like there's not nearly as many opportunities once you're past high school. And if you're not running at the collegiate level, it's very limited. Exactly. So then it's like you're always running, so to speak, with an arm tied behind your back, and in theory, because you got to be a little cautious. And I imagine at times that would be probably a little bit frustrating. For me, it would be if I put myself in your shoes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it is. It is frustrating, but it's like there are certain things I just get used to, right? You just, it's like you come to peace with like, okay, well, I've received a lot of counseling and coaching on this that just don't like it's like those things that, don't worry about the things that are out of your control. Like we can't control the weather. We can't control the terrain. We can't control we will never know the outcome of the race. And we can't even control how we'll feel on the day. All we can do is set her up for success, right? So, you know, you can control what you eat the night before. You can control how many strides you do. You can control like how you feel about it before the race, but you can't control how you're going to feel during the race. You can't control that. Like you can't predict it. You can't predict it. And so it's just letting those things go and channeling that energy into your effort in the context of the terrain and your speed, and just kind of like, okay, dial it in and just, I don't know, go to the bed, like go to the sides of the road. Like there's so many little tactics that I just kind of, you just kind of get used to it if you're doing it long enough. That's what I mean. It's like, it's all about repetition. Running is a very repetitive activity, and it forces you to focus. And it really builds mental toughness to do these kind of workouts by yourself or in races. It's just, obviously racing is not fun if you have no one to compete against. I think it's called a race for a reason. That's why I don't understand the word virtual race. You're racing against what? Like, you must just call it a time trial. A race is someone you're racing against someone else.
Yeah. I ran 4 years of college, and the single most important thing I learned in 4 years of relatively comparably high-level competition was how to run relaxed.
Yes.
That was the single biggest change. I mean, yeah, I trained differently. I trained better. I had better teammates to train with. But the single most important change in me as an athlete was, as our coach would say, I want to see you asleep down the backstretch.
Really? Never at all.
I want you to look half asleep when you hit the cut-in line and you're falling in. I don't want you tense. I just want you to be asleep in the middle of the race. And then you are just sipping energy. You're expending the least amount of energy, but at stride, right? So you can, I ran the 800. You can go out and run their first 400 fast and set yourself up. That's great. But if you do it tense versus relaxed, the exact same pace will cost you exponentially more if you're tense. And so it took me 4 years of running to figure out how to relax while running fast. And what happens the moment, Kirk, like we're on a bike path running in fall or spring, and it's right on the verge of freezing, and there are some patches that are wet and some that are icy. The first thing we do is we tense up our stride a little bit.
Yeah.
And then suddenly threshold pace is 10 seconds per mile slower. My heart rate goes up just because I'm tense.
Yes.
And I can only imagine that right there will never allow you to run your fastest on the road, because you cannot ever be fully asleep while running.
I can't. I just can't. I never thought of it like that. I like that. Be asleep.
Yeah, you'll have to tense up all. You can't bounce off your forefoot the same if you can't trust the foot in. And that would be every stride, it would ding you slightly.
Well said. That's the thing is, that's when That's why I tell people, I advocate all the time, like, never take your sight for granted. Never. Because, or your running ability, it could be taken away in a second. Like Nito's an extreme example. Like, we could all be hit by a car tomorrow, right? It's like, just, yeah, there's a sense of like, how do we be vigilant but disconnect at the same time? I don't know the exact answer, but right. There's a fine mm-hmm. line for sure. Cause like, how do you, cause I think that we run our best when we zone out personally. Like, yeah. You could run your best, you could run faster than you ever thought when you don't think about it very much. Yeah, you sure you have the pre-race jitters and everything. But as soon as you tense up, you lose that precious energy. Because so we're not zoned out. Road race. You're tense up because you're not zoned out.
Let's say you ran a road race at your height of your fitness with 1,000 athletes in it. How much higher would you place if you re-ran it a week later and everyone was on an individual treadmill? How much more would you get out of yourself versus what everyone else would in terms of just not having to stress?
Oh, I think I'd run so much better. My PB on a 10K is on the treadmill.
Oh, yeah.
So I know that question resonates because it's exactly what I did. I had no choice because due to schedule conflicts, I couldn't attend or a 10K race in person because of I was getting married. Whoops. So I had to rearrange it so that I had to do the 10K. My coach had arranged it like, okay, well, we're going to do it on this day. You can pick whatever day. So I did it virtual and I PB'd in the 10K on the treadmill. I was freaking sweaty and just, it was hot. But I was just like, I could just completely zone out. So I know exactly what you're talking about. It doesn't sound very exciting because it's like, there's no finish line. There's nobody there, but it's like, if you really want to get the most out of yourself, it's like, how do you fall asleep or however you put it there? I like the way you put it. I didn't know, I think that's an interesting concept. I never thought of it like that.
Yeah, I'm sure my coach told me a million different ways and that was the one that stuck. But yes. It's cruise control versus constantly throttling.
But we're just raised to believe that if we don't push, we're not going to improve. But research is coming out that that's counterintuitive. For example, we don't actually, you guys know as coaches, that sometimes by training at threshold, somebody have to ride just slightly slower than threshold. To get some, you can get the same benefits by running slightly slower. That's just one example though. Like we all run or easy runs too fast, right? It takes so much practice. And if you run slower, you're more likely to fall asleep on that, like zone out on your, on those days and you recover better. You mentally recover, you physically recover, obviously. And you just get more out of yourself, right? It should be easy. Like it should feel weightless. The whole idea is we love to feel weightless because we're not birds, right? That's the closest thing. We just float across the ground. And if you eat well and sleep well, your running just falls right into place. You can't say the same. There's no such thing as a cycling high. There's a thing as a runner's high, right? I've never heard of someone, I know a lot of cyclists too. And I've never heard someone say, oh man, that cycling high I got on the bike yesterday. Oh, wow. That felt so good. You know, no, it's always the runner's high. We literally run some days to disconnect, to experience the runner's high. And it's not even for our bodies. It's more for our brain than anything. What's for our bodies is those hard interval workouts. That's what happens. The VO2 stuff, the repetitions, the strides, the sprints. That's where the peak art of peaking comes in when you mix your easy stuff with that stuff and it all mixes together and it's like we make it too complicated. And I think just the art of it is just like letting go and that if you let that go and just accept it, then racing doesn't have to be that nervous, like doesn't have to be as, stressful. I don't know. It's like, because like people invest so much time, energy into their racing, right? Because you're paying for it. Like, oh, I want this PB and I'll think less of myself if I don't get it. But then it's like you just, what was the expression I learned? Like learn to enter flow, like flow state. And it's one of the hardest things to learn as a runner. One of the hardest things to learn in my view.
If you're searching for it, you won't find it. My thought is if you're searching for it, you won't find it. Yeah,
It will be bestowed upon you. Yep. And that feeling of floating is really the best description when you're having a good one and it all meets and you feel like you're actually hovering above the ground and you're weightless and the strides are costing you nothing, yet you're running fast. Oh, it's magic. And oh, I wish it happened every run, it's but magic. It certainly doesn't. Yeah.
I
want to ask you about something, whether you're visually impaired or not. Burnout. Yeah. You mentioned burnout a number of times. You said burnt out. We just did an episode this week on our Training Tuesday about racing, like racing too much, for example. Like, what is the right cadence of racing and how do you race your best and all of that? And so burnout's part of that conversation. Talk me through that from your experience. How did you know you were burnt out? What were some of the signs you experienced? How did you get there? All of those things.
Oh my goodness. I have so much to say about this. Okay. So first off, as soon as you don't feel motivated as you used to, that's already a sign. Like, you don't even need to feel tired. Like, you didn't get a good night's sleep. You literally just have to feel like you're not motivated. As soon as you start losing that motivation, I'm not saying like to scrap everything, but literally, people will resonate with people. Like, some people resonate with this. As soon as you start losing motivation, that's a sign one. Second sign is when you don't have the same pop in your step that you used to. And then it escalates from there. So you'll know you have serious burnout when you have trouble sleeping. You'll feel like you're losing fitness. And it's your body's way of protecting itself from getting injured. But there's a sense of, let's put it this way. My opinion, like in coaching and experiencing and running, is that I'm not sure if it's a genetic thing, but most people can only do one good marathon a year. You can only handle one marathon, really good marathon block a year. You cannot sustain that training all year round. It's not possible.
You're like, talking to perform your absolute best.
You can say all you
best.
Want about mindset.
You're talking
your absolute like, best. You can only handle one. Or if you have a natural genetic predisposition to recover fast, you could possibly get away with two. But if we have to look at the Olympic, we have to look at the elites. Ilya Kipchoge only does about two good marathons a year. There's a reason for that. He doesn't purposely go out and race a lot. Like, we don't have to train like them, but they have the same. Like, they're coached by some of the best people in the world. They know what they're doing because sometimes the mind burns out before the body and vice versa. It depends on the phase of life that you're in and what you're under. So if you're under a tremendous amount of stress at work or at home, that's going to affect your running. It's probably not the time to push it. That's the perfect time to disconnect and go enter that flow state. And it's what happens is that we push through that because we think, oh no, well, if I don't do this, I won't hit my goal. Right. But I think we like to think longer term. So I think that the frequency for racing would depend on the distance. But so for marathon, I already talked about the marathon. So I think frequency, one good marathon a year. You can like half ass a good marathon, but to race a good marathon, you only have one good marathon in your legs a year with, you know, the right training and everything like that. Assuming that the stars align. Half marathon, you could do about 2 to 3 good half marathons a year. 10 or 5Ks, those are a little easier to navigate because you can recover fairly fast from them. You don't even need a week to recover from a 5K. And if you do, if it takes someone over a week to recover from a 5K, it probably means they're training too hard. Clearly means they're training too hard. 10K is a sweet spot because 10K is actually one of the hardest distances to race because it requires, you're almost racing at 5K pace, but you're racing faster than half marathon pace. And it's that in-between zone because you're racing faster than your lactic threshold for most people, but you're racing slightly slower than 5K, but it feels like you're running 2 5Ks at the same time. So it requires anaerobic and it requires aerobic speed. So 10K is one of the hardest ones to race. So I think maybe you only have good 10 good 10Ks a year, assuming you're peaking them properly. Middle distance, a little more complicated. This is where people get burned out. Younger people is that they race too frequently because you could race twice. Like in high school teams or like track meets, you'll do a 1500, 2 hours later, you'll do a, sorry, did it hit? So you'll do an 800, then you'll do a 1500 or vice versa. And then some people even mix in a 400 meters near the end of the meet. So you're already racing three big events. That's a lot of adrenaline. So people forget adrenaline. There's like adrenaline fatigue is a thing. So you can't undo that. It can take weeks or months. The genetic component to it, but there is a lot of factors involved for just because this is where, like, you know how much adrenaline it takes to do a good marathon. You're on your feet for 2.5 to 5 hours, depending on your fitness level or your ability. So that's a long time on your feet. And if you're adrenaline fatigued, you're not going to run your best. And the same thing goes. So if you use the other extreme, if you're racing middle distance or even faster, that's pure adrenaline right there because you're literally using fight or flight. So it's very hard to relax your muscles when you're running that fast, but that's where all that training comes in. But you can race too often because the problem is you're doing 800, 1500, maybe a 400 and just picking on those events. But if you do that consecutively for months on end, that's where the burnout comes in. If you did it maybe once a week, you did it once a month, no problem. You could do that. You could probably get away with it if that's your training model. But I think because racing is basically what a racing is that you're out of your comfort zone and you're using adrenaline to push yourself beyond your natural current ability. If it were that easy, it wouldn't be special. It wouldn't be special to do that. That's why it requires a certain amount of mental focus and adrenaline to really do it. And I think burnout is essentially adrenaline fatigue in a nutshell. I'm not sure if any of that kind of corresponds with some of the previous interviews you've had, but that's the things I've noticed. So yeah, I'm not sure. Like injuries, physical injuries is a overtraining thing, whereas burnout is like too much too soon. You're doing it too frequently, training too hard, stuff like that.
Well, I think the tough thing is you realize that in hindsight a lot of times, or it's death by a thousand cuts. Like I kind of felt like crap today. I laid an egg in my race, but I still have another in 2 weeks, and I go do that, and I'm a little disappointed again, and then I'm a little irritable at life, and then I'm restless when I sleep, and then suddenly you're like, oh, okay, something's not going right. But like, when do you know when to pull the plug? Like, I think it's a really complicated thing. Everybody wants to push through, right? Or, oh, I need to train harder. Or, I need to just get more sleep. It's that simple. You know, it becomes webbed, right? And so like, when did you, what puts you over the edge? Like, hey, I need a hard reset. Like I go through that myself. If I have like 3 weeks of bad training in a row, for example, and I'm like, man, I'm just dull and I don't want to, it's my time. I'll take my 7 to 14 days off and I'll start back up again slowly. And it usually works, but I have to like, for like many weeks in a row, be like, this sucks. It's clearly like, you know, I got to trip 3 times before I, you know, start to walk, so to speak. So like what's your sign? What's your recommendation there?
Okay. This is good. This is good stuff. So first thing is listen to your body, respect your body. So one of the last things people learn to do as they become intermediate to advanced is listening to their body. You're not going to get it right the first time, and it's normal. Don't hit yourself for it. So the first time you get burnt out, learn from it. And if you fail it again, that's okay. I think it's the third time that you're like, okay, what is going on here? You try to notice patterns. When to pull the plug. So it's like a kid that puts their hand on the element. You don't know what you don't know. So you don't know when you're burnt out until it actually happens to you. Second time, it's like, oh crap, I tried to push the envelope too far. Okay, great. But then you learn from that. But it's the third time, 3 strikes, you're out. You know, I think the pulling the plug is awfully a complex subject. But from all my years of talking to people, running and everything, I'd say in my coaching experience, I'd say it's when you no longer look forward to it. That's the simplest way. As soon as you don't look forward to racing, oh, I just want to get it over with. I signed up for it. I might as well just do it. If you don't even look forward to running in general at all, or you're just tired all the time, if you're not energized for at least, like, as what was something a coach once said to me, you have to feel good for at least 90% of your runs. So as soon as you start not feeling good for 90%, however you want to measure that, that means there's some diminishing return. right? So maybe you're doing too much volume and maybe just lowering it is the simple solution. But once you're deep in the hole, it's a lot more complicated and maybe it requires you to do more cross training or not run altogether. It depends on your situation because I hate cross training. So I would do anything to avoid burnout, anything, or overtraining or injury or anything like that. It's listening to your body, and as soon as you don't feel like it, like you're not looking forward to anything or you're actually feeling depressed, that's overtrained. Like that's burn and overtraining all in the same time. Right. One other plug is more of a physical thing. So once you're having starting niggles and they're not going away and you're not incorporating mobility or strength training, that's when you pull the plug or you dial it back. So once you physically can't run anymore because it's too painful, you should have pulled the plug a long time ago or backed off or did a recovery week. But then, you know, people feel bad because like, oh no, I'm going to lose all that fitness. No, we actually lose fitness slower than we think. We actually lose fitness a lot slower. We lose muscle mass even slower than that, like physiologically. But it's like pulling the, knowing when to stop is very tricky because the more ambitious you are, the more your ego gets in the way and you're an adrenaline junkie or whatever it is. I think that's where the mistakes are made is when we're too stubborn with ourselves. That's where the mistakes are made. And just realizing that, hey, I'm not enjoying every run. I'm really tired. Just stop. I know it's easier said than done. But first step is identifying, figuring out, okay, why am I not looking forward to this? This is something I used to really enjoy. And this is, I've been feeling this for 2 years. I'm in a hole. I need to get back out. Sometimes that requires someone to be coached. Maybe they need a lot of guidance. Like we shouldn't be doing this alone. Like to reach your potential, no great runner in history has ever done that by himself. Like they've all been coached. That's the benefit of coaching. By being coached, you are decreasing your chances of being burned out because we cannot be objective enough to ourselves to excel at it. We just can't. Like we're always going to be hard on ourselves. We're our worst critic. We're always going to think we're not training hard enough. It's a natural phenomenon. It's very natural. So that's where having a second party interject to objectify it for us. And sometimes when that third time through three strikes are out, that's when I think someone really needs coaching because it's clear they're not picking up on the signs when to pull the plug.
I think it can be very difficult for people to differentiate between wanting to train and feeling compelled to train. Like that difference. I still want to train, you're terrified about not training. You're compelled to train, but you're not truly, if you were honest with yourself, looking forward to training. But because that hard driver is the type who's more predisposed to burning out anyway, they're also predisposed to not, you know, to masking that want versus the need.
Yes, 100%. Yep. We have to let go of our ego sometimes. And that's what it comes down to, where sometimes we compare ourselves to others subconsciously without even realizing it. Like, oh, well, I want to be good as them because their program worked. Why isn't mine? Right. But everyone is so different. Our programs have to be different. Like our journeys are all going to be different no matter what. It doesn't matter what your disability is or like where your background is or how wealthy you are. You could be the wealthiest person and really suck at running and just not know what they're doing. It's all, you're an individual. That's the problem with the sport, is that it's very individual and everyone's bio makeup is different. Biochemistry, physiology, genetics, everyone's joint ligaments have different lengths. Everyone's stride length is different. And when that happens, you can't compare yourself to someone because maybe they just have something. Maybe they've been running longer than you have and all these things, right? I think it stems from comparing ourselves to others fundamentally. And then it just gets worse from there because it's like, well, I want to be on this track team. So I'm going to push myself through it because, you know, I want to make my coach proud. But a really good coach would dial you back. A good coach would actually tell you to not come to practice and take a few weeks off. if you're that demotivated, like I think the drive to compete is very good, but if it's like, if you're not energized, you can be as motivated as you want, but if you're not energized, you're not going to compete. Like if you're DNFing workouts, that's not good. That's not good. Like relative to your natural ability, right? Like we're not saying we should do a Ilya Kipchoge workouts. No, we have to do our own workouts. But if we suddenly can't finish our own workouts within our volume, that's a burnout sign or of overtraining sign. So I would need more context, but the individual, it would depend on the situation.
I think the looking forward to the workout is actually the biggest thing for me. I think it's okay to, I think it's okay to dread a recovery run if it's been a long day or you didn't get sleep and you're like, but for me, it's the quality sessions. It's like, there's a part of me every time that looks forward to going out there and suffering a little bit. Like I can't wait. I watch the clock. There's an excitability, maybe even a little adrenaline response. And as soon as that's gone, I mean, gone. And you're like, I don't want to. I'm not looking forward to this. And that happens, I don't know, a handful of workouts in a row where there's true dread. Like, I'd rather do anything else, like rip out my toenails than go run right now. Then for me, that's the biggest sign. It's that emotional, like, it's a love-hate relationship always, right? Like, don't kid yourself. This isn't a love fest all the time. But the love is far ahead of the hate. And when you start to notice like this becomes negative and it's a little long for me, that's what it is. And then you combine that, you go do the workout anyways, because we're all strong-willed and stubborn, and then you go lay an egg. So not only didn't you not wanna, you forced yourself to, and you went and put a pathetic showing in that you're not happy with. And then you do that a couple of times, you're like, okay, I'm gonna wave the white flag here, it's time. But for me, it's like a part of me has to look forward to like what the suffer or what the push is bringing. Like I need that for some reason. Like
yes.
And when that leaves for me anyways, it's like, whew, you might need to check yourself here, because part of you should look forward to that enduring of the workout. I don't know, Bracken, we never really talked about this, I suppose, but like you look forward to suffering a little bit, right? Like part of you needs that to be your best version, right? And when suddenly you don't, you're like, that doesn't sound good to me anymore. I feel like that's my sign. Do you ever experience that?
Yeah. I mean, I'm lucky. I've never burnt out.
Oh, well, wow, lucky guy.
I found a way to get injured well before that point, but overtraining has never been my thing. But, and I talked about this on one other episode, but we saw that again in the special needs world, there's unfortunately a lot of abuse that occurs in that world.
Yes.
And one of the signs, like, and I've talked about this in the past, so it's kind of a weird correlation, but it just is what it is. Being physically tough is about enduring a certain amount of pain up until a point. And then you actually get less tough.
Yes.
People who've endured a lot of abuse are tough in certain ways, but they're very twitchy and flighty in other ways. Like they're so used to it that they start to shy away from it in situations where it's not going to occur. You know, it's an easy sign around a little kid that if you move and they flinch, like that's a sign they may be a victim of abuse. You see it with domestic abuse as well. Like boxers and fighters get tough by getting hit. But eventually you get hit enough to the point where you start to shy away from it. And that's, to me, that's the same way, Art. The same makeup we have for abuse is the same way training trauma builds up, where you dose it, you get tougher. You dose it, you get tougher. You overdose it, and suddenly you start shying away from even having to consider that option again.
Mm. I think there's a that resonates with me. So the thing is, it should be micro doses. Like we don't need a lot of stress. Like you just need a little bit of stress and that's it. You just need a micro dose of stress and that's it. But like, it's not even enduring the pain. I don't like that term. Like pain has to be like that. Like it's sad. Okay. I used to say this when I do a running presentation, I say, when we have like Jack Daniel said this so well once, and it resonates with me. When we have children, all we do is do encourage them is to play, jump, run, crawl, just for fun, no pressure. And then we put them in a classroom, tell them to sit down and shut up, right? Mm-hmm. And then everything is based on performance. Like you have to perform, you have to do well, or you know, you're like, we're disappointed, right? And it's true. Like our school boards are terrible for physical activity, right? We treat running like a punishment when we're kids. oh, you push that, you push Johnny, two laps of the track for you. We've associated running with a punishment, and that's why the sport of running is not growing, because we think of it as, oh, geez, this is supposed to be this painful experience, when it doesn't have to be. If you run easy enough, the interval workouts should be like, wow, I can release my legs and go a little bit faster. Like, kids love running fast when you give them the liberty and open opportunity to do it. It's when we do it too much, or when you feel pressure to, then it's like you lose that desire. It's not going to be perfect all the time, but I think it stems from childhood, to be honest. Like, there's a little bit of that trauma involved, right? It was, oh man, it was that time when my teacher forced me, that's the key word, forced me to do those laps, or, you know, I'm on school all day, so I'm not motivated to run after school, or, you know, you end up to be a lazy P kid because of your past experiences. And then you try to run, and then it's like doing all the inner work or speed work to try to improve yourself is exhausting. And so I wasn't sure like where to go from there, but I'm not sure if that speaks with you.
Yeah, that tracks.
Pardon?
I said, yeah, that tracks. That falls right in line. That pain, we say it on here a lot.
Yeah.
We Kirk and I talked that those hate yourself workouts need to be very few and far between.
Yes. Oh.
They're reserved for race day. That concept of you're filling up your bucket in training, and that's what you get to bring. The harder you throw that water in the bucket, the more splashes out. What you want to do is arrive to race day with your bucket totally full to the brim, with nothing splashed out, and then you can douse yourself in it. But up until that point, the more you thrash yourself, the less you actually bring to race day. And that flies in the face of the, you know, no pain, no gain generation.
Yeah,
it's the benefit of science-based training, right? You talked about it with threshold training before. Science is starting to finally be able to quantify what runners and coaches, some knew intuitively for decades, which is the return on investment isn't always huge on hate yourself workouts. They can change you for the better when it's infrequently. But they set you back when it's frequent.
Yep, that's true. 100%.
I think I was using the word pain when I was describing quality sessions, and I think that probably brought it. I think I said the word pain a couple of times. So we can point the finger at me there.
Well, there's pleasurable pain, and there's pain in workouts.
Discomfort. Discomfort is,
like, it's
enjoyable.
A scale. It's a sliding scale. Yeah.
It's discomfort. Like scratching a mosquito bite.
I just don't like the word pain.
Yeah.
It should feel challenging. The word should be challenging. It should never be the word pain. As soon as you tell someone that's new to speed training, oh, you just got to embrace the pain. That's a scary word for someone young. That's a scary word.
That's true.
But that's just my views on that. Like, running should never be associated with the word pain. Yes, there's discomfort when you're near the end of a race, but it's just the whole point of the speed training is to prepare you for demands of the race. It sounds too cliche, but it's true. You should be always training less hard than you would in a race. And that's really complicated, and it's hard, easier said than done. But what was it, something Kipchoge said one time? He said, I only train at 70% effort all the time. And it really resonated with me, because it was like, really? Maybe I've been training harder than I've ever had to. I don't know. Yeah. It was just something that spoke to me about, like, he said he only trains at 70% effort all the time. Like, what? And he was like, he's a 201 marathoner. Yeah.
Well, talked about this with Kerry Tolleson last week. It's just like, yeah, what is coaching at the elite level? It's just holding your athletes back, holding them back until it's the right time. All you're doing is putting the governor on them to make sure they don't get in their own way. That's honestly what coaching glorified is at the pro level. And any good coach really is hold back, attack, right? And that's really what it comes down to. And speaking of coaching, the last thing we want to touch on today before we wrap this up, Jared, is so you're a coach for the visually impaired, correct? You coach others?
No, I mean, just in general.
In general? Yeah. I specifically then with the visually impaired, to start this conversation anyways, are there any, like, is it possible, it's like, for example, right now, like remote coaching is more popular than in-person coaching. Like people hire like one-on-one coaching. They hire you, they hire me, they hire Bracken, but we're not with them every day. They can live anywhere, right? You write prescription, you have conversations, yeah. you make the training. Is that possible for somebody visually impaired, or is it entirely dependent on how impaired they are? Like, how do you approach that?
It doesn't really impact me if it's a virtual person. Like if someone lives in the United States and they want coaching, it doesn't really matter because I can magnify my screen. Like it's like, unless I'm watching like a running analysis, mm-hmm. it makes no difference because I know what it requires. Sure. It doesn't impact me as a vision. Like I don't even put it into my vocabulary or my mind when I think about it. It's when if I'm doing in-person, that's different. So like doing a gait analysis, running analysis, assessments, right? And then I'm videotaping them. And then that's just a different, I'm running with them. Like I would try to accompany them, make them feel less alone. And I would try to meet up with them. That's the tricky part. So meeting up with them is more difficult than everything else because the commute, finding them, things like that. But technologically, it's not that hard. Like it's just kind of using ways to magnify the computer. You know, that's it. To magnify the screen. Okay.
Well, I was more asking
I don't know.
Like, let's say we have somebody in the Midwest and they're going to run a big mountain race out in the Rockies, but they don't have mountains in their backyard. It's like, that's a consideration. Okay, what are we going to do with you? How are we going to utilize the incline trainer? How are we going to utilize your local ski hill?
And so
I'm asking, like, if you were to work with somebody visually impaired from afar, like, what are the considerations you would need to consider?
Okay.
Because it's a whole different ball game. You understand what I'm asking? It was a poorly worded question to start.
Sorry.
That's what I'm asking more than anything.
Yeah, okay.
Like, what would we not think about as fully visual athletes that you have to think about every day like that in the coaching and prescription world?
I see it from like, okay, if they're visually disabled, do they have a treadmill? Do they have access to a gym? How much time do they have? So these are just questions I would ask myself and then I would ask them, right?
Mm.
In a session. And do they have access to a treadmill? Do they live near or close to a gym? What equipment do they have? What is your living situation? Like, do you live in the woods? Do you live in the country? Do you live in the city? And like, it's like, if you don't live near a bike path and you live in the main downtown core, that's going to limit you significantly if you're visually impaired because, you know, lights, cars, pedestrians, it's not ideal. So accommodation would be, okay, a lot of your training is either going to be either when you're with a running group or a treadmill. And it's just like finding, tweaking these things so that the training works for someone else. It's not my training, it's their training, right? So it's finding the barriers and then finding an alternative. It's that simple. Hmm. Like, I think I listed a good one right there, a good example.
One of the things we're fascinated with, Kirk and I, and with the podcast in general, is analyzing all the different styles of training out there.
Okay. Because
there's so many training camps, right? So many pro groups that are doing so many different styles. And they jump from one ship to another. But regardless of what your strategy, what your training theory is, you're working somewhere around race pace and you're working somewhere around easy. Whether it's a standard deviation or two from it, it's like they're all doing roughly the same thing. They're running hard, they're running easier. Yeah. Some are very, it doesn't really matter. But from what I've seen, the thing that varies the most from coach to coach is how much true fast speed work gets used, like mechanical speed work, short, fast reps. Some coaches only do strides. Some do like full 200s every week. Whether or not you do 5K VO2 max threshold doesn't matter. It's how much actual true fast work gets done is really the differentiator in a lot of programs. However, that would be in my, having listened to you for the last 90 minutes, that would be the thing I would be the least confident prescribing to a visually impaired athlete because that's the most dangerous style of running. Like, we worry about volume and things like that. I never think about with any of my athletes, you're not going to have good enough footing to run 100 meters all out or 200 meters very fast. How does that get approached from the visually impaired side?
if someone is vision impaired, I have to attack it from, okay, do they have a running guide? Do you have a running club? Is there anyone that's able to guide you? If they don't, then a lot of people that I know that are blind, they use the treadmill a lot. Treadmill running full out on treadmill is quite hard, actually. It's mm-hmm. actually quite challenging. Mm-hmm. It's actually easier to sprint full out on a track or the road than it is to run yeah. on the treadmill. And I say that from a treadmill lover, right? So I worship my treadmill, especially on the winter storm days. And so if someone is vision impaired, if they can't see where they're completely blind, I base it off of their goals. So like most of the time people are going to be doing like their first 5K or 10K. And so the priority is I need someone to have access to a treadmill so they're not dependent on other people. Okay. Because if your training is contingent of someone else being available, you're not going to reach your potential. There's no argument there. Like someone couldn't try to dispute that with me because it's true. Because as soon as you're relying on other people, if someone can make it because their child's sick, so I'm dependent on someone else to guide me to do my run, or how, I don't care how fast it is, or is the tempo, speed work, even an easy run. If I'm relying on someone else and they're not available, I can't do my training just because of something that was out of my control. It yeah. wasn't even weather dependent. It was literally just because someone wasn't available because that was their only way to do that. So running goals for blind people are very, 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 very complex, very different because yeah. you need a support system and you need backups. So I would connect them. So let's say they don't even live near. I would connect them with the closest running group and seeing if there's an association for sport for people that with disabilities or blind, for the blind. And then I would try to connect that person with them and make the connection because everyone needs a support team. You can't rely on just one person. And then, like I said, primarily you need a treadmill, like 100% need a treadmill if you cannot see well. You can totally get away with it if you're fully sighted, but I'm a big believer you need a treadmill if you can't see well.
So then where do you start with that? Kirk and I are both big treadmill guys as well, but I have to imagine that the recommendations we give athletes for what brand to choose differs from yours in terms yeah. of usability with yeah. limited eyesight. Does it need to be something that's very tactile?
Yes.
Or are there voice yeah. control apps? Where are you steering people?
I'm steering them more toward the kind of treadmills that are more tactile. So you can't give someone that can't see well, let's say they're a T12, so they only see shapes and black and white. They're not going to do well with a touchscreen, especially mm-hmm. someone that can only see shapes or it has tunnel vision. They're going to need a treadmill that has buttons, not touchscreens. And it also depends how big of a person they are. So if you want greater range, in case you have really bad balance, you want a deck that's quite wide. So I would look at brands that have a very wide deck. Narrow decks, I've almost fallen off them myself. So yeah, you need a wide belt. Yeah, that's definitely consideration. And it's just the research, really. That's it. Like asking them a bunch of questions. Are you textile? Do you like touchscreens? How much can you see? Do you have any depth perception? If they say no, can you see color? If they cannot see color, then they need purely buttons. They need purely buttons. For phones, I don't think we are advanced enough in technology where our phones are connected to our treadmills. I can't speak on that. But there are, like, you can have a heart rate connected to your treadmill, all that stuff. You can have Zwift, but that'd be very hard for a blind person to do. It's also a massive inconvenience to set up. It's a lot yeah. of work to set that up. Even for, like, it's more built for cyclists, but that's another subject. Like, Zwift is a fantastic resource, but it's not meant for everybody. And then most miles, like for speed work, you can do all your speed work on the treadmill. You just need a good watch. I wouldn't rely on the treadmill for timing because there's no treadmill that will actually have time unless it slows down for you. So let's say you're doing a kilometer workout. You're doing kilometer splits. Okay, great. So you're speeding up. But if you can't see the time on the treadmill, you need a watch. So there's the other question. Do they have a good watch? Do they have a watch that beeps? so that I connect them with the right Garmin Polar. I'm drawing a brain fart, but it's one of those finding them sensory, auditory functions, because it's not something that you technically could use your phone. But running as it requires is a timed sport, so you need a watch. Every runner needs a watch, plain and simple. And I'm not even saying you have to rely on GPS. I just literally mean just having a timer, the beep, if you have it programmed in your watch, and then having the right app that you can see it if you can't see it all. And just have your workouts pre-programmed. And there's a little bit of time management involved, but it don't rely on the treadmill for like intervals and stuff like that, because there's no prompts unless it auto decelerates. Not all treadmills do that. Also, if you want to base it off of heart rate, so sometimes the data gets synced from your treadmill, but you need to have it synced on your phone or your watch. So if you have a watch that has an indoor function, you can turn on your treadmill and it'll work. There's an accelerometer in most watches these days. So you'd save it. A coach would need to have, I'm just generally speaking for the two of you especially, if someone's on the treadmill a lot, they would need to know that heart rate, like their effort, and you would need the feedback too. So having feedback from the person is very important as well. Like, someone could give you the greatest data, but if they feel like shit, that doesn't mean anything.
Right.
Right. Like data only tells you somewhat of the full picture. Like, data can't tell you the wind resistance. Data can't tell you how you felt. Data can't even tell you how much energy you had. The closest thing it has is heart rate, speed, and calories. That's the closest thing it has. Some watches are pretty fancy because they do breathing and power. But I care more about how someone feels. Did you feel strong? Did you feel empowered? Could you have ran longer? Did you run like you could have ran a marathon? That's good information. I care more about that than anything. Because that's what makes it sustainable, right? Like, whoa, that felt amazing. I can't run. I can't wait for my recovery run the next day because that felt so good, you know? And it's like, if they're on the treadmill, for example, or a track an indoor or outdoor track, well, great. Can you see the track? Can you see the lines? So it's like a lot of your training would be on the track, even if it's easy, but it's a way to make someone feel empowered so that they don't feel extra limited, so that you're not dependent on other runners to do your stuff.
Yeah.
The coach and Jared, I know that was a mouthful.
Like, I just hope it was valuable information.
Well, that's kind of the way. That's where the web, you know, goes when you start thinking about nuances of individuals' needs and all the considerations. Like those, most of the things you mentioned are, I mean, some are visually impaired specific, and then a lot of those are like, that's where a coach's brain goes when you start thinking about customizing for somebody's needs, right?
You have to.
Okay, so that was all good stuff, and we're about here. It's time to wrap up. So I think the last question I have for you then is, but if people want to like learn more about you, reach out to you, any of those sort of things, like where can people find you and all that?
I'm on Facebook, so Jared Broughton, and then my Instagram is run2potential, so run and then the number 2 and then potential, it's one word, and then my website is run2potential.com, so... that's the easiest way to find me. And then you can contact me through Instagram or Facebook Messenger. Yeah.
And are you a full-time coach now, or are you dad? Like,
no.
You're not? Okay. Working on that side of the business, we'll call it.
Well, the business, I'm growing my following. I'm trying to gain credibility. That's where I'm at. Cause I'm in my infancy, my first year of the actual business, but I've volunteered. I have an assistant coach of a track club. I've been part of running clinics before. I've run running presentations, but this is my full out like first year of running a side business thing. Yeah. My aspiration is to turn this into a full-time thing and eventually, have my own podcast one day too. So you guys are my inspiration. Mm.
Oh, start.
Well, you're going to have us back on there when that launches.
Yeah.
Well, Brett, do you have anything else?
No, we've taken up an hour 47 of his time. It's been the type of interview where every subject we're touching is something we've never touched from this perspective before. And I am greatly appreciative of you coming on here.
Oh, my pleasure. I hope a lot of it resonated with you or rang a bell or be like, or some things you agreed with. Support.
Well, yes. And thanks for your time. And then, yeah, this thing will be releasing soon. So appreciate it, Jared.
If anything resonated with you on today's episode and you're curious about taking your training to the next level, check out therunningpublic.com, where we have a training plan to fit your needs.